Mr. Paul.
You may proceed.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Warren Long, and I represent the appellant in this tax appeal. With me today is my colleague, Bob Giovanni. This appeal involves a dispute over the interpretation of a release contained in an agreement under which four donated tax is sued to Mistech in exchange for obtaining a charitable tax deduction on the donated items. Despite taking such a tax deduction, despite voluntarily executing a licensing agreement regarding the donated tax in 2006, Ford now contends that it is entitled to make, use, or sell the donated patents with impunity, and that the patents are sued, that the claims are released.
Make, use, and sell products that are covered by the donated patents.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right.
Now, in granting Ford's motion to dismiss, the trial court erroneously ruled that the release unambiguously applied to Mistech's patent infringement action against Ford as a matter of law and rejected Mistech's alternative interpretation of the release to exclude such a claim as unreasonable as a matter of law. However, based on a black-letter Michigan law, the party's stated intent, and the agreement's plain language, Mistech's interpretation of the release to exclude its patent infringement action against Ford.
Counsel, paragraph 3.3 says, excludes by reason of the practice of Ford's patent rights by Mistech, its licensees, or transfers. It doesn't say practice of the patents. It says practice of the patent rights.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that
the only way to make any sense at all of that paragraph, and it is poorly drafted, there are certainly better ways that this paragraph could have been written that would have avoided all of this litigation. Despite that, I don't see a way to read it but for to read it as saying it would apply to practice of the patent rights, i.e. suing someone for patent infringement.
Yes, Your Honor. Let me try to explain to you the reasons why the district court and Ford's interpretation of that particular provision is unreasonable in this case. I think the first thing that you need to look at is the cardinal rule of construction, contract construction under Michigan law, is that you have to adopt construction of the statute.
What do you want me to read this to say, if not practice of patent rights?
Your Honor, I believe practice under the way it's used in the contract, consistent with the party's intent, should be construed to refer simply to the making, using, or selling.
This doesn't say practice of the patent. It says practice of the patent rights.
Yes, Your Honor. And if you look at paragraph 2.1 of the donation agreement, which is on A164 of the appendix, the reason why we refer to the practice of the donated technology, of making, using, selling the donated technology in our brief, which the other side takes us to task for, is that if you look at the definition of the phrase donor's patent rights, it refers to donor's entire right, title, and interest in and to the donated technology. That's why I think it's fair to read the phrase practice of the donor's patent rights in paragraph 3.3 to mean making, using, or selling the donated technology.
But that clause clearly means that Ford can't sue Mistech in any way over the patents. They transferred all their rights. So what can the other clause mean except that Ford is also protecting itself?
Well, paragraph 3.1, and I guess maybe this is how I interpret the court's question, paragraph 3.1, paragraph 3.2, and paragraph 3.3 all need to be construed together. And I think that if you look at them collectively, they all kind of deal with different protections that Ford is being granted under different specific circumstances. If you look at paragraph 3.1, paragraph 3.1 deals with a situation where Ford is protecting itself against an indemnity-type claim by Mistech in the event that Mistech is sued for patent infringement by a third party for making, using, or selling the donated technology. Paragraph 3.2 deals with situations where perhaps a products liability-type claim may be brought against Mistech based on its making, using, or selling of the donated technology. Paragraph 3.3 doesn't deal with indemnity issues, but deals with a release type protection. And it's kind of a catch-all provision in the sense that it covers other situations not specifically covered in paragraphs 3.1 and paragraph 3.2.
I'm still having trouble with 3.3 in the language because I just don't understand how this paragraph could be read as making any sense at all if it's not pertaining to patent rights rather than make, use, or sell. Because look at who's being released from what and who owned what at the time the contract was formed. Okay? So the time the contract was formed, Ford had patents and was donating them to, well, NISTAC or somebody else, and then they got to NISTAC.
His predecessor.
Yes, right. Yeah, NISTAC. Okay, so, I mean, I took out donor and donee and inserted NISTAC and Ford in blocks here, so it would help me understand what's going on. And it says NISTAC, the person who didn't own patents prior to this being signed, agrees to release Ford, its officers, directors, from any and all claims which NISTAC might otherwise have against any of them by reason of the practice of Ford's patent rights by NISTAC. Now, if it was make, use, or sell, how could NISTAC release Ford from making, using, or selling that's going on by NISTAC?
For example, a situation where, NISTAC is attempting to license, i.e. sell, one of the a product covered by the patents, and in attempting to license it, one of the inventors of the donated patents comes forward and says, well, you don't have the right to do so because we still, due to some undisclosed agreement, have an ownership interest in those patents, so you can't do that. This provision would then prevent NISTAC from going against Ford, filing a breach of contract or breach of title type action, based on those facts. And so,
better explain to me again, because I don't think I got it.
Okay. Paragraph 3.1 obviously deals with a situation where NISTAC is sued by a third party for infringement of the patent action. I guess what I hear your question to be is, well, what claims does 3.3 purport to cover based on NISTAC's making, using, or selling the donated patents? And obviously, it's difficult to tell what types of claims might come up in the future. It's speculation, but one type of claim that we envision could come up that would be covered by paragraph 3.3, and that's not covered by 3.1 and 3.2, is a situation, for example, where NISTAC is attempting to license the donated patents to a third party, and it's attempting to sell a product or the donated patents. And
I'm confused. You say this means making, using, or selling. So licensing isn't making, using, or selling. So how could that be covered by your definition of 3.3?
Your Honor, I believe it would fall under the term selling.
Wait, licensing patent rights is the same thing as selling a product for purposes of patent?
Well, selling the donated technology, which would encompass the patents, correct, Your Honor?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Selling the patented technology would encompass also selling the patent rights. Or say this type of selling a product that was covered by, or attempting to license a product that was covered by the patents.
I'm really confused, because I thought that our precedent really clearly divided in terms of when you're talking about making, using, or selling, i.e. for infringement purposes, that is distinctly different from trying to attempt to sell your patent rights via license or assignment. Is that not correct?
Your Honor, I think that may be correct, but I think the point is that if perhaps that isn't the best example to use, I think the basic point that we want to make is that paragraph 3.3 cannot be construed to include the claims based on the right to enforce the patents, because it simply isn't consistent with the party's intent in entering into the agreement.
I understand you saying that, but then if the parties had an intent, I'm having trouble understanding how you would read this paragraph to jive with the intent you tell me that the parties had when they entered it. Because your suggested interpretation is very strained, and I can think of no example for which there would need to be a release of this kind. Whereas their interpretation seems eminently more plausible than the kind of thing that might appear in these licenses all the time.
Okay,
this is why I'm trying to elicit from you, what am I missing?
Right, and Your Honor, and I think we tried answering again. I realize we'll probably do a good job the first time, but paragraph 3.3 I think the purpose was to kind of serve as a catch-all provision to cover circumstances not specifically enumerated in paragraph 3.1 and paragraph 3.2. And I think the reason why it's consistent with the party's intent, and that is is because of this. If you interpret paragraph 3.3 to encompass potential patent infringement claims that NISTAC may assert against Ford, that effectively grants Ford carte blanche to make, use, or sell the donated patents with impunity, without having to pay the owner of the patents a reasonable royalty for that use. That is inconsistent with the party's intent, because one of the purposes for Ford's decision to enter into the donation agreement was to be able to take a charitable deduction on the donation of those patents. And in order to obtain a charitable deduction on those patents, it could not retain any substantial right, title, or interest in the patents, because if it did, under federal tax law...
But this isn't an exclusive license. Nobody has... You haven't argued to me that this amounts to, or that they're suggesting this amounts to, an exclusive license. And a bare license, we have held repeatedly, does not amount to right, title of a patent, because we encounter this all the time for standing purposes. And so in our standing jurisprudence, we always make it clear that a bare license wouldn't conflict with the title type of argument that you're making now. So I don't see how you can say that since their intent was to be able to take a tax deduction, and a tax deduction can't be taken if they don't give away title, I don't see how you can argue that reading 3.3 this way somehow impugns that.
Your Honor, I think the orthopharmaceuticals case that we cite in the brief stands for the proposition, or supports our argument, that the release in this case effectively constitutes a de facto license in the sense that it allows Ford to make, use, or sell the donated patents, a right that it otherwise wouldn't have. But it really is less important what label you attach to the retained right that Ford has as compared to what the actual nature of that retained right is. And the nature of that retained right is that it has the right to, Ford has the right to make, use, or sell the patent with impunity. And under the IRS rulings and other authorities that we cited in our opening and reply briefs, that is deemed to be a substantial enough right to preclude a charitable deduction for that donation.
Now, you cite, I think, a 2004 IRS notice, which seems pretty explicit on the point that you're now making, which is to say, if I hold back a license, even a non-exclusive license, would I donate to you my patent, that I don't get a deduction. Am I understanding that to be IRS's position?
Yes, Your Honor, in the authority that we cited.
Okay. All right. Now, was that IRS's position? That's the 2004 IRS notice. This contract, I guess, is what, 2000?
Yes, the donation notice.
What was the state of the law prior to 2000?
Your Honor, I was not able to find authorities 2000 or prior to 2000 that addressed the issue, but I think that the basic principles outlined in the 2004 IRS revenue rulings and orders, I think, are easily applicable to the case of Barr.
Well, they may be in the sense that if this contract were to come up now and Ford were to say, well, we're holding back a non-exclusive license, that IRS would not let them take the deduction. That seems pretty clear, unless...
Yes, Your Honor.
I wasn't counsel to persuade us in the country, but that, to the extent that we're looking for something that gives us guidance as to what the words should be construed to mean,
Your Honor,
the fact that there was not previous law to that effect from the IRS may be part of it.
Yeah, I think the basic principles have not changed, and I guess we're not different prior to 2000, haven't changed since. And since the IRS has consistently stated that if a taxpayer makes a donation and seeks to claim a deduction for that donation, it cannot retain a substantial interest in the donated items. Any retained interest can only be de minimis.
But I suppose until 2004, it was open to questions what substantial interest meant.
Your Honor, I have not looked under analogous circumstances where it doesn't... I looked specifically for authority related to donation of patents. But, Your Honor, I'm obviously more than willing to submit additional authority to see whether the IRS has considered the issue in analogous circumstances. And the authorities that cited, one of the kind of analogous circumstances they cited is where, say, for example, a taxpayer donates the rights to a movie, but continues to retain the right to... screen that movie or market or commercialize that movie. There may be other analogous circumstances to the patent donation in this case.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Wong. time, we'll restore 3 minutes of rebuttal time for you. And if you'll give Mr. Burrish an additional 3 minutes, please.
Your Honors, good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Eric Burrish, and I represent the Appellee Ford Motor Company in this case. Let me start out by saying that I think there are two things that NISDAQ's reply brief raised that Ford has not had a full opportunity to address. I'm going to focus on those two points right off the start. The two points are that NISDAQ's proposed counterinterpretation of Provision 3.3 is per se unreasonable because it takes out the term patent rights and inserts another expressly defined term from the contract, donated technology. You take out one expressly defined term and insert another. That violates at least two fundamental construction canons from Michigan contract interpretation law.
To the extent that this is abysmally drafted, why don't we construe it against you? You're donating, you're setting up the terms of that donation. Why wouldn't we construe that against you because it's apparently your error?
3.3 is, as Judge Moore said, could have been drafted better. There's no question about that. The question is whether 3.3 is ambiguous or unambiguous. If 3.3 is unambiguous, the doctrine of contra pro forma, thank you, only applies to an ambiguous term. If the terms of 3.3 are ambiguous, then the case should be remanded. I mean, that's the question before the Court. Is it unambiguous or is it ambiguous? If it's unambiguous, you never get to that doctrine in the first instance. But let me explain why 3.3 was written the way, in the terminology that it was written in. What 3.3 reflects is...
Did you write it?
I did not.
Okay, I was just wondering how defensive you were going to be about it. Go ahead.
So, yeah, feel free to say whatever you'd like about it. What is going on there is that the parties were intending to use a defined phrase, donated patent rights, and they were intending to do that in a very inclusive manner. And I think the phraseology that you see there was the parties' attempt to incorporate that defined phrase. From 2.1, we see that patent rights is defined to be the entire right, title, and interest in and to the donated technology. And the next sentence expressly states that assignment and contribution includes the right to enforce. So we know, as a matter of law under Michigan contract interpretation, that the express definition must control. Another fact that I think we need to be very clear about is that the phrase donated technology is another defined term in the contract in section 1.1. So we have two separately defined terms. Now in this tax reply brief, they say two very interesting things on page 22. They say, in order for their interpretation to work, donated technology and patent rights are, and I quote, a distinction without a difference. In other words, they are the same thing. That violates Michigan contract interpretation law for the simple reason that Michigan contract interpretation law says you cannot render a term surplusage or nugatory. If two express definitions mean exactly the same thing, you have rendered at least one of those definitions surplusage. Secondarily, on page 22 of their reply brief, NISDAQ says, and let me see if I can quote this, that donated technology, as they want to use in 3.3, must exclude the right to enforce. In other words, they take out patent rights, insert donated technology, and then explain that it must exclude the right to enforce. But we have seen in 2.1 that the phrase patent rights expressly includes the right to enforce. So NISDAQ is asking this court, in the context of a litigation-induced rewrite, to expressly redefine a term that has already been defined in the contract.
It strikes me, and comment on this if you would, but it strikes me that your problem is not so much with the term patent rights as it is with the term practice. If this clause 3.3 had said that the donee agrees to release the donor from all claims which the donee might otherwise have by reason of the donor's patent rights, then you'd be on, it seems to me, very solid footing. But it says the practice of the donor's patent rights. And practice, to an intellectual property lawyer, would seem to me to have a pretty restrictive meaning, and this, I gather, was reviewed by intellectual property lawyers. This wasn't something drafted by somebody in the real estate section, I take
it. It's not in the record one way or another, and I can't
speak. I thought there was something in the materials that suggested that. But in any event, looking at plain language in the context within which it appears, it seems to me that the word practice suggests something other than enforcement. So that's my problem with your case. It's not the patent rights, it's the practice problem.
And I think that hones in right on the heart of NISDAQ's argument. They say practice is the key word, when in reality it's the phrase practice of the patent rights, as Your Honor appropriately alludes to. Practice of the patent rights. Now let's start from the premise of patent rights, that it expressly includes the right to enforce. That's defined in the contract. You plug it into 3.3. So now we know that we are dealing with the right to enforce. Now, NISDAQ invites this court to take, I believe you said, a constrained or a technical view of the phrase practice. And I say fine. I don't think that that's necessarily, or I do not believe that that's necessary. Let's take practice as a general term. We've said apply, carry out, those types of words. And NISDAQ says make, use, or sell. Assuming for sake of argument that NISDAQ is correct and it should be make, use, or sell, then plug it in. Make, use, or sell the right to enforce. In context, you're not going to make the right to enforce, and you're not going to sell it, but you can certainly use the right to enforce. So now we have a clause that says that Ford has a release when NISDAQ uses the right to enforce. There is no ambiguity there, which is why NISDAQ must take the next step and say, take out patent rights and put in donated technology. And furthermore, exclude the right to enforce that is expressly included by Section 2.1. Again, Michigan contract law, I want to get this side into the record.
The right to enforce, you say, is explicitly in 2.1? I'm sorry.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right to enforce, okay. That includes, all right, assignment and contribution includes the right to enforce, okay.
And assignment
enforce and patent rights, all right.
Assignment and contribution.
The assignment enforce. Includes the right to enforce the patent rights.
Correct.
But that's not the same as saying the patent rights include the right of enforcement.
Well, I think
in fact, you could even say that it excludes the concept that patent rights include the right of enforcement, since the right to enforce is defined as something that's done with respect to patent rights.
I think that's an interesting point. I'm not sure I fully tracked it. Let me see if I can paraphrase.
Well, it's actually, it borders on sophistry. I was interested in the reaction.
I think that actually is a fundamental point, because NISDAQ is again excluding the right to enforce from patent rights, and they're saying that patent rights must be the right to make, use, or sell the donated technology. But as this court is well aware, patent rights in general cannot convey an affirmative right to do anything. Patent rights are not the right to make, use, or sell. Patent rights are the right to exclude others from making, using, and selling, and that is the very essence of the right to enforce the patent rights. So by using the phraseology patent rights, by specifically calling out the right to enforce in 2.1, the intent of Section 3.3 could not be more clear. It was to
cover. Oh, it sure could be. I understand that it could not be more clear is a standard phrase that lawyers make about contracts, but that's serious here. This is the problem. This is not a could not be clearer type case, right? And we can all agree to that.
I think we could all agree that you could specifically state NISDAQ can't sue Ford, and that would be more clear.
Right.
But if you do that, the problem with drafting contracts in that way, and the reason people do not draft contracts in that way, is as soon as you begin listing specific rights or specific causes of action that are covered by, for instance, a release, you have, by negative implication, omitted any causes of action you don't express the state. That's why you take an all-encompassing term like practice of the patent rights and you draft the release
broadly in
that way. Well, you were
just about there with any and all claims, weren't you? Why did you just stop there? Any and all claims can't be brought, period.
Well, any and all claims is broad. And the right to enforce the patent rights is broad. That's the breadth of 3.3, I believe, is clear on page 3.3.
I'm contesting whether it's difficult to draft a release. It seems to me like you and I could sit down and do that in 20 seconds, and we wouldn't have to litigate it for years.
And if that were the standard for determining whether or not there is an ambiguity, then there would always be an ambiguity because you will always have opposing counsel coming in on the other side of the case and saying we can dispute this or that because a particular phrase wasn't drafted as clear as it could have been. But Michigan law, and I'll cite the Gortney case, specifically said that the mere fact that a party can introduce a dispute and say, for instance, that it could have been more clear does not demonstrate an ambiguity.
On this, if we can move for a moment to the tax issue, that is raised by the fact that the memorandum does reference Ford's intention to take a deduction. Would you agree that the IRS material cited in the blue brief, specifically IRS Notice 2004-7, would disallow a deduction in a case where the donor retains a non-exclusive license to practice the invention?
I think if, according to the IRS regulations that were cited by NSDAQ, and I agree that they were not timely, and I was going to raise that point that you've raised already, the fact of the matter is that if you have a retained interest in the property, that will have an impact on the deduction.
And disallow.
I don't believe that's right. I think you could take reduced deductions. I think there are a number of various, it's not an all or nothing approach. It depends on the rights that are being retained. But the fundamental premise of NSDAQ's argument is that Ford retained an interest in the patents, while it is expressly clear on the face of the patent that Ford intended and did in fact give up all right, title, and interest in and to the patents.
Well, but the IRS defines, as I understand this notice, the retention of a non-exclusive license as a retention of an interest, and protection against suit is effectively the same thing as a non-exclusive license.
And Ford has pointed out in his brief, Your Honor, the distinction between a non-exclusive license and a release. As this court has recognized in the standing cases that Judge Moore alluded to, there is, in the context, I believe our Ortho Farm case was comparing a non-exclusive license to a covenant not to sue for purposes of standing. There, the court found that a covenant not to sue was not a property interest in the patent. There was no retained interest in the patent. And that's relevant when you carry it back to the different context of the IRS, where the IRS looks at whether Ford retained a property interest. Now, if Ford retained a non-exclusive license, that has impacts. As we've alluded to in the brief, it's upstream, downstream impacts that come from having a license. That is different than a release, where Ford is in a contractual relationship with NSDAQ that protects only Ford. Those are different types of provisions. It's not a non-exclusive license.
How are Ford's rights different? I'm not sure I follow.
And again, I think this belabors a point that doesn't necessarily
need to be made. I understand you don't think this whole tax debate is really terribly germane to the construction of the
For an important reason, but it comes out of the contract.
But just to finish the point, I'm losing you about where you were saying that there's a big difference between having a license to practice the patent invention versus having a covenant not to sue for practicing
or a forward-looking release, as the case here.
What's the difference in Ford's position in those two situations?
If Ford has a license, a non-exclusive license, then Ford can make, use, or sell with authority to do that. That is not an act of infringement because it's licensed. Ford's subsequent purchasers at that point have an implied license because our sale under the license gives rise to an implied license. While I don't want to allude to the fact of what other NSDAQ cause of actions could exist here, when Ford has a release that simply says we are not authorized, if NSDAQ is correct, which is, you know, we strongly dispute whether we're making, using, or selling the technology, but assuming NSDAQ is correct, that is not an authorized use by Ford, and therefore would not give rise to subsequent rights. There is a distinction there.
So you think under this clause that your customers could be sued even if you can't?
I think the contractual release pertains to Ford. But the interesting thing that I don't think has been reflected in the briefing very well, because NSDAQ has stated what the intent was. They say Ford's intent was to take a $26.9 million tax deduction.
You think if Ford has a license or a covenant not to sue for making, using, and selling, the customers could still be sued? And didn't Qantas do something about that? Doesn't patent exhaustion extend to insulate the customers Ford would sell them to?
In the context of a license, yeah. I think that, that Quanta didn't reach a contractual agreement between the parties. Here's why I think that this is a belaboring point that this court does not need to get to. 2.4 actually reflects the intents of Ford. 2.4 states that the donor intends to claim an appropriate tax deduction. It does not say that Ford intends to take a $26.9 million tax deduction. It doesn't say that Ford intends to take a full tax deduction. It says that Ford intends to take an appropriate tax deduction. It does not say that Ford intends to take an appropriate release in light of a full tax deduction. That's what NISDAQ would have you consider. If an appropriate tax deduction in light of the release is zero, and I'm not a tax attorney, I am, as you probably have guessed, an intellectual property attorney, and I don't propound to be the expert on the distinctions between a license and a covenant not to sue because I don't think it's particularly germane to this case. That being said, if the appropriate tax deduction is zero, then Ford's intent was to take zero tax deduction at the time. What NISDAQ is asking this court to do is look after the fact, after the entry of this contract, and determine whether the actual tax deduction that Ford took down the road was in fact appropriate. And that is extrinsic evidence that cannot be considered when you have an unambiguous contractual provision. Now, NISDAQ has turned the concept of the party's intent on its head. It starts from the starting point that Ford intended to take a tax deduction and NISDAQ intended to do certain things and therefore interpret the release in light of that intent. That is backwards. That is not Michigan contract interpretation law. I would refer the court to the case of In re Smith Trust, which is 745 Northwest 2nd at 754, where the Michigan Supreme Court has stated that where contracts are unambiguous, or where language in a contract is unambiguous, courts must interpret and enforce the contract as written because, quote, an unambiguous contract reflects the party's intent as a matter of law. In other words, if you want to find the intent of the parties, look to paragraph 3.3. It tells you in black and white what the intent of the parties are. Well, Courtney, which is cited in our brief, goes further and says, in light of that intent as expressed in the unambiguous language, contradictory inferences become subjective and irrelevant. The reason for that being, they are subject to different interpretations. If a contractual provision is unambiguous, as 3.3 is, you do not look to external sources of purported intent.
Let me make sure, because it's important to me, it may not be ultimately critical to the case, but I want to make sure I understand your distinction between a license, which you say is not involved here, and a release, which is what you say, as I understand, is involved here. You are saying that a license gives protection to the downstream customers that a release does not. Is that what I understood your position to be?
I think that that is a distinction that Ford could have recognized when
drafting. Well, I mean, just in terms of the law of patents, is that the distinction that you would identify between those two concepts?
That is the distinction that we discussed in the brief, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Birch.
Thank you.
Well, we have 3 minutes.
At the beginning of Ford's rebuttal argument, they focus exclusively on how the contract defines the terms donor's patent rights and donated technology. But I think Judge Bryson hits the nail on the head in pointing out that regardless of how those terms are defined specifically, even if you assume that Ford's patent rights is defined to also include the right to enforce as well as the right to make use or sell, the key term in paragraph 3.3 determining the scope of the release is the word practice. And word practice in the contract is undefined. And under Michigan law, if a term is undefined and there is a dispute as to how that term should be defined, the court can look at a number of different considerations in determining how that term should be defined. And a couple of those considerations are directly relevant in this case. For example, the course of conduct between the parties.
He went through an exercise that I thought was interesting when he said, well, go ahead and insert the words make, use, or sell in there, and we still win. Now, he got wrong the sell part, because of course you might want to sell it if you sell a patent for a short time. But make didn't make sense, and use did, so use patent rights. So why doesn't it still come out in favor of Ford then? How is that wrong?
And Your Honor, I think, you know, where that comes from is that I think Ford takes the position that patent rights refers to the right to enforce only, and perhaps a misunderstanding that already on this point. But if you look at
paragraph... I think they did argue that. I think they said it included.
Yes, right. That's certainly what the agreement says. And so our position is that because the term Ford's patent rights is defined in the agreement to mean Ford's entire right, title, or interest in the donated technology, then it could also include the right to make, use, or sell the donated technology. And that's the argument we're making.
But I don't think that gets you there, though. The fact that if the word patent rights encompasses both make, use, or sell and enforce,
yes,
you still lose. You have to show it doesn't include enforce.
That's right, Your Honor. I believe that's where the term practice comes in, because the way that practice has traditionally been understood under patent law is that it refers to the right to make, use, or sell, or includes the right to make, use, or sell, and based on the way the word practice has been used in other provisions of the agreement, based on the course of conduct by the parties, practice has been used in this particular contract to refer to simply the right to make, use, or sell, and exclude the right to enforce. And I guess that's the point that we were trying to make, is that the key term is the word practice in paragraph 3.3, and the narrow the qualification that it gives to the broader term for its patent rights, and that's how you can square the reasonableness of the interpretation of NISDAQ's interpretation of the lease in this case. There's been a lot of discussion as well, and may I put my thought here?
Your last thought, Mr.
I would just conclude with standard review to make 100% clear that in order for this court to reverse the trial court's judgment, this court need not conclude that we are the only, under this text interpretation, not the only reasonable or even the most or equally reasonable interpretation. Otherwise, it only needs to be a reasonable interpretation.